Hello, this is the Love Letter Squad. I'm Teresa Ayers.
And I'm Janet Gowan, and we are happy to welcome you back to another Love Letters Live. And as you may know, some of our listeners do, of course, this is a half hour of stories and love letters. And we feel that most experiences in life, positive or negative, carry within it some grain of gratitude and thanks and someone who should be made aware of your gratitude and thanks. So we say, why take that gratitude to the grave with you? It doesn't do any good. Why not share it and say what you feel while you still have the chance, as Teresa says all the time. Very important. Today our guest is Jalen Ricks, who is a sexologist and author of a book called Ex-Gay, No Way. So, Jalen, I want to go right to you. Just tell us about your life and the experiences that led you to this, and what sexology, why don't you start with what sexology does.
Sure. Sexology is the research and education of what people do sexually and how they feel about it. Now, that's a pretty basic.
It is broad.
Yes, it's broad and basic, but in this society, with all the confusing messages that get put out there and all the different convictions and ideas that go on, it can be sometimes nothing but, or anything but, clear and...
What are some of the confusing messages that go on today?
Well, a lot of them come from history. A lot of misinformation.
Like what?
Well, you know, like 100 years ago, they would talk about, you know, you'll go blind enjoy yourself or anything like that. And
if you enjoy yourself by yourself.
Right, yeah, right. Thank you. I didn't know how explicit you wanted me to be on the show. And yet, you know, we kind of laugh about that now.
Yes, we do.
But 100 years ago, quite literally, these were the medical authorities of the day saying, oh, don't do that, or you'll, you know, hairy palms, you'll go insane.
No, I understand that.
Yeah.
But my question is, and maybe you're the one to ask, since you know about these things historically, what was the evidence that you would go blind?
Well, there was this gentleman named...
And hair can't grow out of palms.
What?
Hair can't grow out of palms.
I know. I don't know how they got the ideas.
I think it was a scare tactic, right?
Some of it was.
And the clergy used to.
Yeah, yes, that's what I'm saying. I think it was just a conspiracy.
It's odd that, I don't know if you know who John Harvey Kellogg is. He's the man that's on all the cereal boxes, mm-hmm. Kellogg cereals. Well, he had a sanitarium.
Yes.
The Battle Creek Sanitarium. And quite literally, his way of deducing the scientific method is that he noticed that a lot of the people in his sanitarium would pleasure themselves,
mm-hmm.
and that was his scientific method of, oh, we'll see if you pleasure yourself.
But did they go blind?
Insane.
Oh, insane.
Yeah, well, there would be a whole list of things.
And
you know, I mean, we could get nitty-gritty about
right.
who said what, but all those messages still... kind of hang. I mean, we're still
really?
Joking about it.
Right.
And
but apparently cornflakes will cure that, right?
Yes, actually bland food. Him and then Sylvester Graham of Graham Crackers.
Uh-huh.
They named the crackers actually after him because he suggested that if you eat Graham flour, it's bland food and that will curb.
So is that where the phrase going crackers came from?
I don't know.
Maybe that's why we give them to children.
Yeah, you know, I wonder if that's why I got Graham crackers in Sunday school when I was a little kid. I did.
Probably. Okay, so how do you fit into this? Do you see clients personally to help them, to guide them through personal...
I do. I see clients as a sex therapist. And it's not psychotherapy. I'm not a psychotherapist,
mm-hmm.
Even though there are aspects of psychology going on. But we get right down to the nitty-gritty rather quickly.
And do mostly gay men come to see you?
I advertise mostly uh-huh. in the gay community in San Francisco. But I have all kinds of clients that come
to
see me.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And
for any kind of sexual issue.
Yes, yeah. And a lot of couples that come. And it's really exciting because it's not rocket science. And
right.
usually I can give them a little education, send them home with homework, it can, you see change real quickly.
And people need permission, I would guess.
Yes. Yes, that's actually the number one statement of a sexologist is giving permission.
Is it? I would imagine
giving permission to talk about it, a safe place to talk about
right.
things like that.
and the name of a good eye doctor, just in case.
Right.
Okay, so do you have a website you'd like to share with us?
Sure. I mean, right now, if you want to get information about the book, the easiest one is xgaynoway.com.
Okay, xgaynoway.com. Right. Love that title. EXGAYNOWAY.com.
Correct.
So tell us about you and your childhood and, you know, from early times, like what led you to this path?
Yeah,
and being comfortable enough with your own sexuality that you could guide others.
Sure. I grew up in a very conservative Southern Baptist home, and the upbringing was very, very good. It was over in the Sacramento Valley.
Mm-hmm.
Southern Baptists are in California, too. Some people are surprised
sure.
at that. And as you can imagine, for the most part, I either didn't get much sex education or it was fairly negative, you know.
Now, what is negative sex education? Well, Harry Ponson
going
blonde.
Don't touch down there, God will utterly reject you if you have sex before marriage, things like that. And
so I'm taking it that your parents didn't. There was a time when people didn't have sex before marriage.
Right.
Well, I shouldn't say
yes.
that. I'm sure there's still a time where people,
yeah,
yes.
That's still a very big movement that does not. At least they profess they don't.
Right.
And, you know, I suppose that sounded rather judgmental, but we all have to make responsible choices. And I, for one, am someone that feels that responsible choices can be made out in the open, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, when there's such negative and such strict ideas, we end up making a lot of choices out of shame or in the dark. And was the case with me when I discovered my sexuality was different from most of the people around me.
Was that really confusing for you, or you knew what you were looking at?
At first, it was just completely innocent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just seemed
sure.
like, you know, I just assumed everybody thought this way.
Uh-huh,
but then
sense.
I began to realize I wasn't seeing it the way, you know, the other boys would talk about girls, and I'm like, boy, I'm not feeling that. So I kind of went into hiding. There became a schism, you
mm-hmm.
know, the way I was on the outside and the way I was on the inside. And that went on into college. And eventually, I began to get some therapy on it. And actually, I got a good therapist. The college
nice.
Put me through to a good therapist. But I was going to get rid of this quote-unquote problem.
Oh, you felt that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You could be ex-gay?
Well, at that time, that was one of the only choices I knew to, quote-unquote, get rid of the problem. So I went to a drop-in group, which was much like AA,
mm-hmm.
For about 8 months. And did everything
may I, may
they told me.
May I ask what
me.
Year this was? I'm so curious.
Yeah, it was mid-80s. Mid-80s
okay.
is close enough to say, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of back at the beginning of when they were the ex-gay movement was really getting going. And they could get away with saying, just pray to God and go
I
to
see.
Church and memorize scripture, and God will make you
I
straight.
I just didn't know when that was historically that took
yeah,
off.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
that was, yeah. I mean, they started around the mid-70s when they took homosexuality off the psychological community, took it off the DSM, DHM.
Oh, as a diagnosis.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
They took it off, and then the religious people said, what? You're saying this is no longer an illness? So it kind of was a reaction to that. And so the ex-gay movement got started
What about before the mid-70s? Is that when we just didn't talk about it at all?
No, actually, that was when the psychological community was trying to figure it out. And as a result of their research, say, in the 50s and 60s, some of it not very sound research, but as a result of that research, they realized that homosexual people can be just as healthy as heterosexual people, minus the stigma that our society
yeah.
can put on
them. Well, I remember in the 60s and 50s even, that the psychiatrist's offices were filled with people who were trying to become cured
right.
of homosexuality.
Right.
What an unfair burden. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
That's
well,
everyone.
And thank goodness the psychological community began to see that
yes.
and put a stop to it. Unfortunately, these fringe religious groups still quote that research very, very... they pick and choose the information, but they still quote that research as gospel. And when I was coming out, it was still very... I was still trying to figure it out,
But when
too.
You say that research, what research?
Well, If you look at some of the research in the 60s and 70s, even though the result of the research comes to the conclusion that they're healthy, if you look at it, they go into the research with a great bias that something's wrong. And so we're going to try and figure out what the cure is. Well, by the end of the research, they realize, oh, there's nothing to cure. Well, the ex-gay community and these ministries will go back and quote parts of, they'll pick and choose the information and say, see, because you had an absent mother or absent father.
Right. Oh, they used to say what, strong mother, weak father.
Right.
Bingo.
Right. That's right.
Yes.
That's
so what was your own journey through this ex-gay?
Well, you know, I tried everything they told me to do. I worked very hard.
What they tell you to do?
Well, they would use those ideas of the passive father, aggressive mother. One of the things they would do is pair you up with, say, a mentor, someone who's been in the ministry a little bit longer, which would usually be a gay person, and you know, so that you could have a strong
male.
Yeah. You know, whatever. They're very tied up in masculine, feminine role models. So you'd be given this male role model. And yet, you know, we'd spend time, nothing would happen. I just didn't see how the leap would be made. And I saw some of these connections, some of these relationships, older man, younger man, and they would be going through the organization by living in a house. It would be a 24/7 kind of de-gayification. But these two people would behave in every way like a gay couple, except not sex. I don't, you know, and even that was sometimes questionable.
Sure.
But, you know, after a while I began to see that their tactics, there was a lot of denial going on. You know, I'm just going to depend on God and try to ignore this stuff.
And
over
so you
here.
Were encouraged to date women?
Yes. They understood that, you know, I couldn't just right away do that. But boy, that would be a sign that you're becoming straight.
Right.
And I was dating a girl at the time, but you know, I was also seeing her best friend, who was a cute blonde guy. But anyway, that's why I went to the ex-gay organization in the first place.
And so what was your exit from that?
Yeah, it got to the point where there were just too many red flags. Mm-hmm. And I knew better. I was trying to consume all the information. And I was beginning to see the holes in their therapy, quote-unquote. And even in their holes in their approach to Christianity, in that, you know, this thing that was supposed to be all-encompassing, unconditional, inclusion, love, was actually a very kind of work ethic. You know, it kind of whittled down to, I would feel really horrible about myself unless I could follow all the rules, a very kind of legalistic approach. And, of course, they couldn't see that, because they, I kind of liken it to, a person who is anorexic, and they can look in the mirror, and they might be thin as a rail, but the only thing they can see is an obese person, and that's the way. That's the brainwashing they would give you. You know, it doesn't matter who you really are. You are a straight person, and so when you look in the mirror, you saw a straight person, even though you know that may in reality not be what's going on the inside. And there would be a lot of cultic aspects that were turning up as well. Just sent red flags for me that I had to kind of back off.
Now, where was your family during all this? And do you have brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have an older brother who's a Southern Baptist minister, and my parents are a fundamentalist as well. And at that time, when I went through that, I went through that by myself. I was hoping to, quote-unquote, solve the problem.
Oh, and come home whole.
Right, exactly. And it wasn't until several years after that that I was in the process of accepting myself unconditionally that I had the opportunity. Well, I kind of got dragged out of the closet.
How?
With my parents. Well, I was kind of beginning to educate them, you know, just nice little messages every once in a while. Oh, my friend in San Francisco who happens to be a homosexual. Uh-huh. And they, you know, they're pretty smart. You know, they began to see through it. So they started questioning me one time over dinner. And by the end of dinner, you know, they were kind of freaking out.
Oh, they were?
Oh, yeah. Mm. You know, wailing and gnashing of teeth don't compare. But actually, it's been an amazing story, and that's actually been part of the book is, you know, there was a number of years there, about seven, that they were very active in trying to change me to be straight.
Now, why do you think? That always interests me.
Yeah.
They wanted to change you because?
Because they felt like the only way I would be acceptable to God was to be straight.
Oh, okay. It's not because they wanted grandchildren or they wanted you to be safer in the world.
And, you know, those feelings are all in there.
Uh-huh.
But for my parents, their main motivation was, you know.
Not going to heaven.
Right. Potentially, I could go to hell. And, you know.
And then they'd never see you again because
exactly.
They're going to be in heaven.
That is the most important thing to them.
Well,
so.
Sure.
But I was also in the business of trying to educate them. But over the years, it got worse and worse and worse till there was not a visit that was a qualified war zone, you know, that we could.
And
we
now? Could, are they past this?
Well, about 7 years in, I finally put a moratorium on the topic, you know, religion
mm-hmm.
and homosexuality. Unfortunately, that did whittle our relationship down to just about nothing. But you know what? My parents are content with that. And I had to come to the grips with that if I expected them to accept me unconditionally, I was going to have to be the example in this
yes,
situation
isn't that
and
true?
Learn to accept them unconditionally.
Now, are you single?
Yes, I am now.
So I don't know. Will you be, if you do meet somebody you want to spend a life with, will you be able to bring that person home?
Or? Well, I had a 12-year relationship during that time,
uh-huh.
and I was not.
Uh-huh.
I can say by the end, towards the end of the relationship, they were. They did finally kind of, yes, they did actually invite Leo back to the house.
Oh, how nice.
And
okay.
so that was very nice.
Yeah.
You know, when we talk these days, if we were to get into it, I know their convictions, they
right.
know mine, and we're able to kind of keep love
Except.
The focus.
Nice. Now,
and,
what?
Yeah.
Tell us how you got into writing that book.
You know, when I came out of the ex-gay world and then graduated and began to accept myself unconditionally, out of the woodwork came people that had gone through the ex-gay ministries, too. And some of them had had far worse experiences than I had. I went to the drop-in group. There were some people that went to the live-in groups that when they couldn't cut the mustard, quite literally, they were put on the street. No job, no family to go home to. Now, and they had to start literally from from scratch. And I saw these people, and there was just nothing out there for them to, like, read or what do you do now.
Oh.
And so back then, I would just kind of print things up and staple it together in a little folder and hand it out. And it was actually called XK No Way.
Uh-huh.
And now that I've gone through, eventually I felt like I needed to get an education. You know, I went to a Christian college. I had a minor in theology. I felt like I knew that side of the story. I felt if I was going to speak with any authority, I needed to get the other side.
What did you get?
I got a Doctor of Education in Sexology.
Good for you.
Yeah, and it's been a great, great experience to kind of balance all that stuff out, integrate my sexuality
and also to come to people as an expert. It's nice to have that behind you.
Yes.
So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. It is nice to be able to...
In this day and age where people ask all the time, you know,
right.
where did you study or what?
Right, right. And it was a great education. So I, not only do I speak from experience, I feel like I can also speak from... I have the information side of it.
So there were people all along your path who were squarely on your side in life who helped
yes.
you through, or were you pretty much a lone traveler for...
You know, I can say that I never was completely alone, and that's great. When I came out at the end of college, I had a handful of friends who maybe didn't understand completely,
mm-hmm.
but they weren't going to reject me. And, you know, that was gold. You know, there's
uh-huh.
just nothing I can trade.
And where was
that.
College?
I went to Westmont College in Santa Barbara.
Nice. So here's my question.
Okay.
Teresa and I both are firmly convinced, and we see this all the time, and I think it's true, that in every story of life, every journey that we take, there's somebody along the path who's been on our side.
Mm-hmm.
And as we are about love letters,
mm-hmm.
and love letters not just for romance, obviously, but any kind of gratitude or to remember something positive, mm-hmm. if you were to write a love letter right now, which we're going to ask you to do,
okay.
And I don't know that you have someone in mind or have ever thought about who you would write to.
Hmm.
Who would get a letter from you?
Wow.
Because you're talking about some of those people in college, and I think sometimes a letter 20 years later that you you stood by me. I mean, just a thank you for who you were to me
mm-hmm.
is talk about gold.
Yeah.
I actually got one 50 years later.
That's great.
And I could barely breathe.
That's great.
There's no statute of limitations on I remember how good you were to me.
Yeah.
And sometimes that can just change a person's life.
Sure.
So who, I don't know, who would you?
You know, there's so many. And there's a number of people that, it's funny in thinking about coming onto your show, a number of people that just pop right away into my head. And actually,
who are they?
They're all no longer around, unfortunately.
They've all died,
but,
you mean?
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, I can also think of others, too.
Wait a minute. Hold that thought.
Okay.
Because we're big on writing letters to people who have passed
sure.
on. And I think that's a wonderful thing to
sure.
do.
Sure.
And, you know, dear so-and-so, I'm writing this to you knowing full well that I do not have a forwarding address.
Right.
Something
right.
like that. Mm-hmm. But I want you to know what you were to me. And for somebody who, for a writer, where would you send such a thing? Where would you mail such a thing?
Well, it's interesting. There's one person particularly in San Francisco that I met in San Francisco who is a massage therapist,
mm-hmm.
Older gentleman. And he, you know, when I came out of the ex-gay environment and come out of a religious environment that is not terribly body positive,
mm-hmm.
He was a person that accepted me with his hands
mm-hmm.
and made me feel comfortable in my body even when I didn't feel comfortable. And oftentimes we end up making massage be very, very therapeutic, which is good, you know, work
mm-hmm.
out the stress in your muscles and stuff like that. But there is also an aspect of massage that is about acceptance and unconditional love. And just by touching. And he was amazing in that. He was my massage therapist for about 7 years, and we became very good friends. And
is he still living?
No. Oh. Out of the blue, he got throat cancer
mm.
and went very quickly.
Does he have children?
He does not.
In his family? I see, I'm thinking sometimes it's so nice to write a letter like that to the next of kin.
Right. Well, you know, I had actually a wonderful opportunity at the memorial service. I ended up being his executor.
Mm.
And some of his nieces and nephews came out of the closet and they came
out of the woodwork.
And, you know, at the memorial, it was very great. They just said, you know, please tell us about our uncle.
And
so it's been very nice, yeah.
Well,
so I was able to tell them and stuff.
And you have their addresses.
You know, I would have to do some digging. But
well, you could, right?
Yeah, I could. You know, I'm also thinking, though, about a professor in college named Rusty Springer, who is here in San Francisco. And, you know, even before I had accepted myself, I would see her kind of on a regular basis, sort of like a therapist. And she was a woman that just without any doubt and any reservation just accepted me and let me go through my process. And I know she's done that for many, many students, gay or not,
mm-hmm.
That were really in need of an authority figure that would be compassionate and loving. And she's incredible. So.
And you know where to find her.
Oh, yeah, I do.
Okay. So, yeah. I mean, I can see that you have a whole nice little list of love letters
sure.
to do. But so you could certainly write one to her.
Mm-hmm.
And what would you say to her?
I would say, oh, Rusty, after all these years, I really appreciate you still staying in touch. And even when my book came out, you sent me a letter of congratulations. And your presence of unconditional love and compassion and acceptance through all my stages in my coming out in college, even when things didn't go well with Stuart, and you were still supportive of both of us through the years. And
how did that make you feel?
It just made me feel so accepted.
And did that change how you went about things at all?
Yeah,
that feeling of being accepted?
At the time, I had, you know, we tend to just run in our own generations. And because I had experienced so much rejection from, say, a generation that is ahead of me, or several generations that are ahead of me, several up there that are older than me. I had an incredible fear of any kind of authority figure and an incredible distrust of authority figures. And people like David, who was someone that was, say, about my parents' age, but was able to touch in a healthy manner, just blew this idea of mentoring out of the water for me. And so it was with also you, Rusty, that you were one of the first people that was, say, around my parents' age, and you were so distinctly different that it gave me hope that I could eventually have peace, so to speak, with people that were of different generations than I. And that has really stuck with me.
So, and how long has it been since you've been in touch with this Rusty. With Rusty?
We had lunch maybe 3-4 years ago.
Okay, and you know where to find her.
Yeah.
Oh, this will be wonderful. Will you write to her?
Sure.
Okay.
I will. I'll even tell her about this show.
but she should get your letter first.
Oh, okay.
Shouldn't she?
Sure.
So, and then definitely she should know about this show.
Yeah.
Well, I was curious, and often we talk about the specifics of her, and you elaborated, you know, how she made you feel and what she did for you, but are there some things about her that you'd like to... How did she do these things? What was there about her?
Yes.
I could see many times, or many, I can remember occasions when I'm sure I was just going off, you know, that I would just, I would be so pent up, I'd be so frustrated, and I'm sure she could have stepped in and said, look, here's what you need to do. And, but instead, she let me have my process, and she consciously made choices of acceptance and compassion so that I would be able, I mean, you know, one of the things that happens with Christian kids is we're very, we're spoon-fed a lot of things.
Sure.
And so by the time we reach adulthood...
She let you be.
She let me make decisions for myself.
Okay, now I know the reason Teresa asked that question is because sometimes the specifics is what makes a good love letter a great love letter. And sometimes even physical things, even the way you looked at me, what came out of those beautiful blue or brown or green or gray eyes, it's something that she knows you were paying attention to the real her, just like she was paying attention to the real you. And some of those specifics. I'm going to just leave it to you because we're almost out of time.
Okay.
But I'm going to just leave that to you to remember specifics,
you
know. So anything, you'll know what that is.
Right.
Any
kind
of physical or emotional specifics.
Yeah.
And then all these other people, if you wrote letters to the nieces of this person and sent it, it's part of your history. It's part of sexual history in this country. How valuable to have that on paper to be somewhere forever.
Sure.
And no one will throw it away.
That's very good.
Well, Jalen, thank you so much for being with us today. So interesting. We could go on and on. Unfortunately, we cannot. But, again, thank you for joining us. Thank you to our listeners. Please join us every week at this time, and in the meantime...
Please remember that if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, that writing a love letter is a special occasion.
Indeed.
So, till next time, from Teresa...
And Janet.
Bye-bye.
Bye.